Aha.
Hello.
Me
Oh,
with
nice
him.
to see you.
Nice to see you too. It's weird. I've never quite sorted this out because my camera is in one place and then my screen puts you in another place. So I'm looking at you, but it probably looks like I'm looking off to the side or something.
That's fine. Because that would be what it would be like if we were walking together, wouldn't it? We'd sort of be side looking at each other.
I was just listening. I like snuck in and listened to a couple of excerpts from some of your podcasts. And I love that you record them on the hill, the sounds of nature and everything going on in the background. It's so magical. It's so much better than, the normal studio recorded podcast. I'm sorry that I can't just pop over and go for a walk up one of the cliffs and do it where it should be done.
No, it's great to be able to connect like this. This is the first one I've recorded that's overseas, so this is really exciting for me.
I'm glad we made it happen. And thank you for reaching out. Yeah, Kinder is special to me for so many reasons that we'll get into, I guess.
What's it like where you are? I've never been to Colorado.
I mean, there's a real range in Colorado, as there is, in back in Britain. The difference from coastal walking to the peak to Lake District to Scotland, there's so much diversity. And in some ways, there isn't as much variation here. Once you're up in the high country, you have deep forests, which are much wilder than the woodlands by the reservoirs in the heart of the Peak District, because you have the wildlife there and a lot of it's untracked, and you have 14,000 foot mountains, which in some ways don't feel any bigger than Lake District fells because the vertical relief is similar. The valleys are at 10,000 feet and the summits are only 3 to 4,000 feet higher than that. So you kind of get the scale is curiously like being in Scotland or the Lake District or North Wales. But then, of course, when you're walking uphill and you've got a big pack on your back, the thin air emphatically makes its presence felt. It's definitely harder. And of course, we have guaranteed snow in winter on the high mountains. The snow can fall in late September and it typically doesn't thaw away completely until July. So you're guaranteed white stuff, and sometimes too much of it. I miss mild midwinter backpacking trips where you can sleep in a tent and it's above freezing and you're not fighting that side of things. Even when I was walking back home, winter would always come and go, and I would always watch the weather forecast avidly for John Ketley or Michael Fish sticking that snowflake over the hills. And as soon as it was there, I'd jump on the train and dash up north and get to the hills. And by the time I got there, the snow had almost always invariably vanished again. I remember turning up beneath Kinder one Friday night when snow had been forecast during the week, and I got there on a Friday night. It was dark, but I hiked straight up Grimes Brook, and the snow was deep. It was like 2 feet deep drifts, and I was so excited. And I pitched my tent halfway up the cliff. I like stamped down a platform of snow and pitched my tent on it, and like thrilled for the weekend, the white weekend that lay ahead. And then it started pouring with rain overnight, and it washed all the snow away, apart from the platform that my tent was on. So I was like camped on this only small, 6 square feet of snow in this grey, grim, dripping clough by dawn. Yeah, so many moments where I chased the snow and it vanished as soon as I got there. The walker I used to be, yeah, would love the Colorado snow I now have. It's weird, like we have so much sunshine here. We have 300 sunny days a year, which is not what you get in the Pennines, right? But it's funny, that can sometimes be too much because I miss wandering in the mist, and I miss the sideways rain, and I miss the bogs squelching underfoot and being cold and damp. There's like something to it which is lost when all you have is good weather that you can easily deal with. It's funny. I kind of live on the edge of the foothills of the Rockies, like between the big city of Denver and its massive metro area of 3 million people. And I'm separated from the big city by two flat-topped mountains, which are known here as mesas, which is, Spanish for tabletop. And the one I live directly underneath is very reminiscent of Kinder Scout because it has this big plateau on top and it has steep, rugged edges all the way around it. And little drainages, which few people explore because most people stay on trail, which is probably good because the landscape is delicate here, more delicate than back home. But when on the rare foggy days, or when it is raining, or when it snowed hard and the clouds are down as well, I love to kind of imagine I'm back home on the hill that, started it all for me. even though it's worlds apart, 5,000 miles apart, and it's 6,000 feet high rather than 2,088. And by the way, I apologize that I work in feet rather than meters, because I've been here long enough now that I've been unmetricized, if that's a word. So yeah, I love going up into the Colorado version of Clag and striding around the edges and feeling like, well, I could be back on Kinder if I stretch my imagination a little bit. Although, of course, up here you have danger of running into mountain lions or coyotes, and in summer we have rattlesnakes and bears occasionally wander through. And of course, in summer the lightning storm thing is much more of a risk, because you can almost set your clock by the time of day when the thunderstorm is going to roll on through. So you can't necessarily stay up all day. Being burnt to charcoal by a lightning strike isn't the ideal way to enjoy a day in the hills.
What took you there to Colorado?
So I came here to do a long walk after the bigger walks I did back in Europe. I wanted to go somewhere slightly wilder. So I came up with this plan of walking all the way from the Mexican border to Denali National Park in Alaska. So heading all the way up the Rockies, the American Rockies or the United States Rockies, and then the Canadian Rockies, and then continuing from the end of them to Denali National Park. And the aim was to spread it over 2 summers, to not spend the winter on foot, but to go back home to London and then come back again in the spring and then continue the journey. But it was during the first summer of that journey, when I was in northern Colorado, that I met someone who I got on well with. We had a fun evening in camp with her and the group she was camping with. And because I'd been on my own so long, suddenly spending time with another person my age was, such a lift. And that first summer didn't quite go as planned, because it was a really bad forest fire year in the American Rockies. And by the time I got to Wyoming, a lot of land north of it was actually closed. You weren't allowed into it. So I had to stop really early, which meant for the second summer, I'd have to start really early. And the only way to make it viable was to ski the first part. And because I'd never skied before in my life, that was a bit of an issue. But I remembered meeting this woman who had volunteered to teach handicapped kids how to ski. And I thought, well, if she could teach handicapped kids how to ski, maybe she could teach me. So I came back early and spent a week learning to ski, staying with her and her friend in the home, sleeping on the couch. And it was during that trip that I fell in love, which changed everything. Like, suddenly I'd always been focused on the trail, on the mountains, on adventures outdoors. And suddenly I had something else pulling my heart in a different direction. But anyway, to cut a long story short, we stayed in contact during my journey and then did the transatlantic relationship thing for a while. We ended up falling, completely in love. When it came to choosing where to live after she said, yeah, foolishly said yes to the question. I wouldn't have said yes to me. There was something wrong with her, but still. We had to decide where to live, either my place, suburban London, or her place on the edge of the Colorado Rockies. It wasn't a tough decision. At least for me, it wasn't tough at all. And so, yeah, that brought me here. I moved here in 2003. So I haven't been on Kinder since 2002, 22 years.
Wow, do you
It's
miss
tragic.
it? Sounds like you really miss it.
There's so much about England and home and Britain and that I could miss if I let myself. But it's one of those things, isn't it? There's no point focusing on what you don't have, especially when you don't have it through deliberate choices you've made. And it would just be a self-centered indulgence that serves no purpose whatsoever. So I tend not to let myself miss stuff. But of course, knowing that we were going to talk and made me think about Kinder a little more. And I was browsing through some of my pictures and reading some of the stuff I've written in the past about Kinder Scout. And of course, pulling out my first map I ever had, which is right here beside me, this map of Kinder, and staring at all the places that I explored and bringing back all those memories. It has made me feel incredibly nostalgic for the hill. And also, newly appreciative of what it means to me still, because of how foundational it was in my own outdoor journey. It was my first real taste of the wild. When I first went there, I thought of it as the wilderness, which clearly it's not. But it was my first taste of a big wild place that's utterly alien to anything I knew growing up in the suburbs of London. It used to terrify me or intimidate me, and I had no skills, no confidence in my ability as a creature of the planet to navigate the wild planet. But then slowly I grew to know it and love it and understand it. I had this deep emotional connection to it that will never change. It was the first time I stood alone in a natural environment and felt as though I might be 1,000 miles from any other person. And I never had that growing up in London, obviously. You know, I was rarely more than 20 meters from another person. Yeah, I managed to be metric for once.
What
And
was
yet,
it that prompted you to go there in the first place then?
when I went to college, I wanted to choose a college that was nearer hills. I'd fallen in love with the idea of the hills and wilderness through The Hobbit first, a book I read 100 times when I was 7. And that sounds like an exaggeration, but it may not be. And then through reading James Herriot's books when I was a teenager, it just lit something inside that I didn't understand why it called to me so much. It just did. So when it came to choosing a college, I needed to be a graphic design course because that's the direction that I kind of got pushed into by people who advised me that being an artist wasn't a viable career. So I had to do a commercial version of that. I was misled by my advisors in my youth, I think, but whatever. So I chose Derby because it had a reasonable graphic design course, but more importantly, it sat beneath the Peak District, which was, you know, kind of James Herriot-like. Got to college in late September 88, 1988. And the first thing I did after dropping off my bags was to jump on the bus and go up to the Peak District. And thereafter, for the next, you know, few years, every single spare moment was involved with jumping on a bus or a train to get into the hills. I completely neglected what I was should have been at college for. And I have absolutely no idea why the graders of the course at the end passed me, because I definitely did not deserve it. I was barely there. So yeah, I went to Derby and discovered the Peak District, and first of all travelled in the White Peak because it wasn't quite as scary as the gritstone moors. Then I found, you know, the Roaches and Axedge Moor. And finally, in October 88, went to Kinder Scout for the first time. And yeah, I fell for it instantly. It was so much bigger than anything else in the Peak District. I mean, it's only a small hill. It only rises 300 meters above Edale. It's not a big place, but to me, it seemed epic. And it seems bigger than mountains seem to me now here in Colorado, just because it was novel and exciting. And I remember following the Pennine Way variation route onto Kinder rather than Grimsbrook, because Grimsbrook was just a little bit too scary for me. But then when I got onto the top, decided to try and find my way to the highest point, just because, you know, it was my first visit to the hill. Unlike many visitors to mountains, I thought, you know, it's all about the summit, which of course it's not with Kinder. If ever there was a hill that's not about the summit, it's Kinder Scout. It's about a million other things. And that was my first encounter with peat and peat gruffs and peat hags, and the first time I've sunk knee deep into a landscape, which was I didn't have gaiters. It was amazing I didn't lose my boots. I had corduroy trousers on and knitted woolly socks, and I was completely inappropriately kitted out for the conditions. Fortunately, it was a perfect day. It was clear and sunny and mild. There was no wind. And by luck, more than by judgment, I found my way to the highest point, which was just a pile of stones, and it had a stick rising out of the stones. And there were three other bedraggled looking walkers who were also at the top. And I can't quite remember now. It might have been the fact that they were there led me in that direction. And I remember they were complaining about, oh, look, the highest point of the Peak District is a rotten piece of wood and a screw sticking out the top of it. And once they'd left, though, I just stood there and looked around at this alien landscape that's probably, you know, I've been to a lot of places since then, and few places are as removed from normal modern day living as the summit, as the whole plateau of Kinder Scout is. And it just blew me away, the uniqueness of it and the feeling of remoteness. And you know, I knew that Manchester wasn't that far that way, and Sheffield wasn't far that way, and Glossop was just down below, and yet here I was alone in the world and alone in this epic place. And it both intimidated me. I felt very nervous and unsettled until I got back to the main trails. But it also lit something inside that I didn't understand at the time, but I do now, having written 2 books about, you know, long walks. It fulfilled needs that I didn't know I had and wasn't able to articulate as an 18-year-old. And yeah, it just kept calling me back again and again for all kinds of different visits and different conditions. That's the short answer of how I got there. Now, do you want the long one?
That's what fascinates me about Kinder Scout, though, is that that's the why the sort of main reason why I started the podcast is because people do return to Kinder Scout. Not everybody, but there's a few people that do return time and time and time and time again. And obviously, it's partly because there's so much to explore up there and so many different routes. But I think there's more to it than that. There's something really, well, some things that are really unique to people, and it's through this podcast that I want to explore that. It's, by asking not just what but also why. And I mean, why do you think that you've explained it partly because of that feeling of being out in the wild and the remoteness of it. Do you think there's anything else that drew you back to Kinder Scout in particular, rather than the Dark Peak or other mountains?
I think there are so many levels why it calls. I mean, there's that individual personal emotional response to me because it was where I had a series of firsts, you know, that first encounter with peat and that first taste of real wildness. And I bivvied on Kinder for the first time. It was my first time, you know, sleeping out in the mountains without a tent. The first time I encountered thunder snow, you know, climbing up to cross the plateau in a winter blizzard. And as soon as I stepped onto the edge of a plateau in the fog, in the driving snow, completely soaked to the skin, excited to cross it to get back to Edale on the other side, as soon as I took that first step, there was this flash of lightning, an instantaneous crack of thunder. And I turned about on the spot and, you know, started dashing straight back down the way I've come. I'd never changed my journey, my route in the mountains so swiftly. All these kind of thirsts. So there's an emotional connection because of that, because it's so foundational to what I inherently was as an animal connected to nature. But as I was as a young person, a young, sheltered, shy, stammering individual from the suburbs, suddenly discovering the real world of nature out there. So there's that emotional response. I think it's partly because I'm aware of Kinder's history in the fact that 1700s it was accessible to ordinary people. You know, agriculture didn't really use it, industry didn't use it, and then suddenly it was closed off because there was suddenly a passion for shooting grouse. And so ordinary people no longer had access to this place. And so the whole campaign to regain a moral right to access to wild places gives Kinder Scout especially such incredible meaning. And being aware of that, I think, increases the emotional appeal of it. But I think also partly it's the unique nature and characteristics of the mountain itself, its unique topography. I mean, I don't think there's another mountain in the United Kingdom, or maybe anywhere on the planet, or in the entire universe for all I know, that has that steep-sidedness rising up to that crazy flatness on top. I mean, it is a unique plateau which offers this, yeah, alien world on top of it. And then so many wonderful nooks and crannies to explore, you know, from the downfall amphitheater, which feels like a little corner of Iceland, to some of the less visited cloughs, which are full of little intricate secrets that most people don't experience because they stick to the main paths. I mean, if I lived in Grimsby Booth for the rest of my life, I wouldn't need anything else because there is so much up there that you could explore. You know, there's 1,000 places you could camp. One of my favorite trips to Kinder was doing a 3-day walk. It essentially involved going up Grimsbrook, walking along, coming down Golden Crough, then going up Onnensbrook, then coming down, you know, just spending 3 days going up and down each of the cloughs and camping in three different spots. And that was done like 3 years after finding Kinder, and I thought at that point, I'm getting to know this hill really well. And then I did that and I realized, you know what? I know nothing. There's so much here that would repay slow, immersive exploration. So I think those three primary reasons for me sum it up. You know, it's the personal experience, the known history, what it means to thousands, tens of thousands of walkers, generations of people, and just, yeah, the incredible uniqueness of the hill itself.
I used to live in Grinsbrook, Booth, and I remember thinking exactly the same. I could just very happily live here, explore this place for the rest of my life because it just seems completely limitless in terms of what you can, yeah, see, feel, experience up there, learn about it. It absolutely fascinates me. So you're definitely speaking my language here. I read in your article that you sent me as well, which was absolutely amazing to read, that you used to run here as well.
Yeah, I used to, yeah, when I was in Derby, take the train to Sheffield and then across to Edale and then camp. And I would do a long run, typically around the edges on the Saturday, and then go for an easier walk on the Sunday. And just, yeah, doing the loop around the edges, 15 miles when you're up there, more or less, depending upon whether you cut across in places to shorten it a little bit. It's just such a fascinating way to experience the hill. Walking reveals it in a certain way, and the slowness of it has so many benefits. But running just changes how the hill hits you because, panoramas come and go more quickly. So you kind of see the big picture more condensed, which kind of somehow gives Kinder a more instantly knowable shape than if you're traveling at 3 miles an hour or 1 mile an hour, depending on where you are on the plateau. And also, when running, you look at your feet a lot more than you look around at the big views just because it's necessary. But somehow, that focus on the immediate in front of you also reveals the details of Kinder Scout in a different way. So, yeah, running up there was always a treasure. And a couple of times I pushed it hard and I realized that like doing it to run a fast time was completely missing the point of being in nature and what the mountain was. For me, I get why people, go out to do fastest known times and win the Edale Skyline race and, do the Pennine Way faster than anyone's ever done it before. I get that. Personally, I learned to be a slow runner and a very slow walker and a very immersive backpacker. It's not about distance, it's about time. And my favorite thing to do is to walk a few miles, 2 or 3 miles to a spot, and then spend just 2 days there and really soak it in. And that's what works for me.
How do you think it prepared you for your big expeditions, then also perhaps leading into writing?
Yeah, I guess it confirmed. Even when it was at its worst, when I was cold and wet and miserable or lost, or misplaced, because you can't really get lost up there. You can, well, I guess some people can. It confirmed that what I'd felt called to do for my teenage years, to be out in nature, was absolutely the direction in life I was supposed to take. Because although it was intimidating at first and physically challenging and uncomfortable, it was also so right to be in these wild places. So, and because of the nature of Kinder's unique challenges, I guess it gave me the confidence eventually to move on to, I guess, so-called wilder places. But then, I mean, in truth, in the heart of Kinder is as wild as anywhere I've been. It might not have grizzly bears, but it doesn't matter. It's like the emotive response, the perception you have of what you are as a tiny being in this vast, unhuman place. Inhuman, unhuman place has a profound lasting effect. I was brought up in a society that taught me to fear nature. You watch t wildlife documentaries on television, and humans are never shown in it. It's always the nature, the animal, the creature, the place, and we're always removed from the picture. And then you read stories on the news about planes crashing in the wilderness, and no one survives, and people climb mountains and then they perish. And my most impactful book, The Hobbit, Bilbo Baggins set off from the safe Shires into the wilderness, and the wilderness was full of goblins and trolls and dangers and murky forests. And my dad, who was naturally cautious when he first learned I was going to spend some time walking the Peak District, was so concerned for me and telling me there was so much to fear up there and so dangerous and I shouldn't be doing it alone. And I remember the first time I walked up Grindslow, what's it called? Grindslow Knoll. And I got on the stop where the pile of stones is. And then the fog suddenly dropped down enough that I couldn't see where I'd come from. And when it was time to go, I suddenly thought, Oh crap. I have no idea which direction is which, and just the speed become disoriented up there. I did have a compass on that occasion, but it made me appreciate how wild Kinder could potentially be. So yeah, I guess it began the journey to not seeing nature as an adversary to fear, because I eventually grew comfortable there. And although when I knew Kinder, I wasn't able to articulate what I now can, in the fact that nature shaped us, it gave us all of our skills, all of our innate abilities, our emotions, our senses, our instincts, our very physiology and bodily functions are all key to how nature shaped us. And so we have that innate connection with nature because we are part of it. I grew up separated from nature and believing I was separate from it. And that's why when I go back into nature, that severance from nature is gone and I suddenly feel so incredible. I guess Kinder began that journey to acknowledging my real place on the planet that I didn't have growing up in London's pleasant leafy suburbs.
Wow, what an impact that is. That's massive, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it changes your very view of existence in some regards. And so many people, so much of the United Kingdom population is an urban, suburban population. And even more so now, you have kids growing up with heads bowed over their devices constantly, getting that dopamine fix from their devices rather than all of the natural beneficial chemicals which spill into us when we step out into nature or into a forest or onto a high hill. These people are human beings, are animals of a planet, but they're so divorced from it now. It's a shame that nature isn't part of everyone's daily life. I mean, imagine if our governing ministers spent 20 minutes sitting under a tree every day and went up to the hills every month just to experience what the real world was, what a different place the British landscape would be if they had that connection. It's an innate thing, but it's lost to so many people, or at least it appears to be, which is why the world is in the mess it's in.
Do you think that that then inspired your work, your career?
Possibly, I mean, it's hard to know to look back because what happened happened. Since reading The Hobbit and reading James Herriot books, I always wanted to write myself. So I always had that dream of being a writer. And it was one of my favorite subjects as a child growing up and going to regular school, writing essays and stories. My spelling was atrocious, it still is. My typing is even worse. But that's beside the point. Part of human nature is wanting to connect with others and share our own experiences. It's like what made us the successful species we are, because we're able to storytell and share, and that helps us work as a social species. We're stronger together. And so this natural inclination that some of us have to tell stories and write about our own experiences is just an extension of being human. And one of the things, like one of the key parts of my journey, and especially of Kinder Scout, was I grew up with a really bad stammer. When I was a child, it made social situations absolutely horrible. I had to stand in front of the school class and read aloud from an English from a book because the teacher thought it was a good idea, maybe because she wanted some light entertainment herself. It was just horrible. And throughout my teenage years, I became a loner and kind of a social. I was completely inept socially. I had very few friends. I didn't have a girlfriend until I met and fell in love with the woman who's now my wife in my early 30s. That's how impactful the stammer was. And so when I went into nature on my own, it was like one of the few places I could really just relax and be myself because there was no real pressure of social interaction and embarrassment. You pass a walker on a path and you say, "I'll do," and that's it. And I could manage that just fine. But if someone wanted to actually stop and talk to me, suddenly, my face would go red and wasn't a pretty scene. Kinder Scout was the first place. And the Peter Street, when I first went walking by myself, where I could finally relax into who I was, unconcerned by the demands society put upon me to engage with other people. That long journey of going through someone who was a loner by necessity and then choice, and then convinced himself that that was all he really needed, eventually going for bigger walks. My longest walk was 18 months long. And that forced me to finally confront the fact that actually, hang on a minute, I do need people and I am part of a social species. And we are a social species for very good reasons. Maybe you need to adapt. And now, because being in nature gave me the confidence to be myself, and I finally trusted my own validity, my own opinions, I realized actually, you know, there is some logic in them, even though advisors in my youth scoffed at them. They actually do have value. And that like self-confidence that grew from being alone in nature, which started on Kinder Scout, eventually gave me the ability to trust myself and 99.99% of the time to throw off my stammer and talk like a regular human being, if that's what I'm managing to pull off right now. I think writing is the best form of, for me, it's the best form of therapy I could have taken. And especially writing at a level where I push myself to really understand the whys of what happened. You know, why is the world the way it is? Why is society the way it is? Why have I become who I am? Not, as you say, not just the whats, but the things that really underpin it. And so the therapy of exploring all of that just gave me that belief in my own opinions and as I say, my own ideas. And even if they only work for me, they're real because they work for me. It doesn't matter if other people would, you know, scoff at what I've said or written. I had like a really bad review of one of my books because she thought I was a hypocrite in how I was saying suburbia didn't fulfill me and it was wrong for me, and that it was actually the stuff that made me, you know, the environment that made me who I am. And she took umbrage to this because she took it as an attack on her own environment, which was interesting. And once upon a time, that would have upset me. But now I realize that it doesn't matter because it is true for me. Like trying to teach my own kids that self-confidence that I didn't have, it's like such a valuable lesson to pass on that what you think is valid because it's what you think, and how you react emotionally to any situation is valid because it's an emotional reaction that is based on who you are, and to trust that, trust your instincts, trust your emotions. If you're nervous up in the mountains, that's valid. It's not something to be ashamed of or to hide. It's there for a reason. Listen to it.
It came to me quite a bit later on, you know, in my like 30s, that I first started learning how to navigate and just, well, just even spend time up in the hills. Grew up in Norfolk and then I moved down south, so I wasn't used to these mountainous environments. Yeah, spending time here, I was really nervous, but then people started to help me and then I learned those skills, and through that and spending time on my own as well as with others sometimes, yeah, my confidence has really, it's changed so much. When you were describing yourself as a youngster, I was very, very similar to that. I was so shy and felt like all the teachers at school were against me and not really helping me. And yeah, and I found it really hard being in the city and yeah, trying to find my way through it all and just not really getting anywhere. It's only ever since I discovered a different place, different existence, as you described it, that I've started to figure out who I am and what I enjoy and what I'm good at.
I think a lot of people can identify that, partly because it's based on that innate connection we have with nature, which is lost in the urban environments we tend to live in. And yeah, I think that's exactly why the generations of visitors to Kinder have been called back again, because it's been called back to a side of who we are, which normal human life just doesn't reach. It's why the place is so special.
You mentioned in your article, I know you wrote it, it was 2005, wasn't it? The one that you sent to me. I absolutely love reading that. And one of the things that you mentioned in there were Kinder's secrets. And I'd really like to ask you a bit more about that. What did you discover while you were spending time up there?
I guess it's the small, intimate places rather than the big grand views, you know, rather than the big grand views from the north across to Bleaklow or, you know, overlooking Hayfield and beyond. It's just those little nooks and crannies. Like one of my favorite cloughs is Blackton Clough on the northern side, climbing up from the Woodlands Valley. And you can make the journey up as fun or as difficult or as easy as you want, depending upon the route you pick. And I found several plunge pools, which on hot summer's days are just fun to, strip off and sit in, and you have small ash leaning over and a waterfall splashing onto your shoulders and no one around. You can hear golden plovers singing or skylarks twittering endlessly overhead, and the skylark, that's a bird I miss so much, or could let myself miss so much. It's this cascade of joy coming from the sky that skylarks bring to the British Hills. Yeah, it's just finding those small places where you can just sit and enjoy, the details, even if it's like a nook somewhere off the beaten trail in the middle of the Woolpacks, where you're hidden from the masses passing by. It's dropping down into the amphitheatre beneath the downfall and just hanging out for a day. It's those kind of secrets where you feel like, I know that, I guess that's the whole thing about Kinder, is even as an adult, or as a young adult when I was there, because in 2002 when I finally went there, I was 32, so it's been a while ago now. I still felt like on Kinder I was getting away with something. It's like normal life is over here, and when you head up onto Kinder Scout, you can get away with something, and it's almost like you're being naughty. You're stealing a moment for yourself in this world that demands a different way of living. I guess that's one of the secrets. It's a getting away from it, a getting away with stuff sort of place. I bet a number of people feel like that. You climb up onto Kinder, you're just getting away with it a bit.
Yeah, I think so. When you moved away from Derby, what happened after that?
So after college, I went back to London because I didn't have any money. So I went back to live with my folks. I had to get a job because that's what society demanded of me. The expectations were, you after college, you get a job, you start saving for your retirement, which I did because I didn't really know. No one told me there were any other options. I didn't have the imagination or confidence to pursue any other options either. So I had a job, as a graphic designer, just a few minutes from home, which I hated. I was fairly good at it, and I knew it was a life necessity to pay my way, earn my keep. But I knew deep down that it was everything life was not supposed to be for me. I had this growing anxiety that I was stuck in the London suburbs, working for my retirement 40 whatever years away, and it was wrong. It was just completely wrong, and I didn't know why it was wrong. I just knew it was wrong for me. So the 4 years that followed, even though I escaped to the hills whenever I could, which was a little harder to do from London, but I still did it. It was probably the most anxious period of my life because I knew deep down that I wasn't being true to myself. I understand why mental health issues arise from people who are forced to be what they're not in society, whether it's a gender they're not, they're forced to fit into a certain binary which they don't fit into. I understand why people end up committing suicide because the world just isn't meant for them. And I never got that anxious or that depressed, but on some levels, I wasn't far off. So I was stuck there in London, taking all my annual holidays in the mountains. And on one of them, when I was 24 and I went for a week in Switzerland, I ended up falling 1,000 feet down a glacier. A series of circumstances and bad decisions on my part led to what should have killed me. Fortunately, it didn't. I got very lucky. I ended up falling down this 45-degree slope, and after bouncing and spinning, cartwheeling, I ended up on my front and spread myself like a star and dug my fingers into the snow, which kind of shredded my fingers and tore several fingernails off. But miraculously, I came to a halt. And the euphoria that followed when I realized how fragile life actually was, because when you're in your early 20s, death is so far off. It seems so academic. It doesn't apply to me. Even though intellectually it will, you can push it aside. But I suddenly was confronting the fact that life was so fragile and such a precious gift that I had a duty to myself to live the life I felt I was supposed to live. And it
Wow.
was quite a revelation. And rather than, nearly dying in the mountains, forcing me to give up the mountains, it did the opposite. It finally gave me the confidence to give up work and go off for my first 6-month long hike. And it still took a while because the shackles that had been set over the previous 24 years had been were very strong. You know, I'd been brainwashed. I really had to believe that life had to be what it was. It's so arbitrary, and the society we live in is so arbitrary and such a thin veneer of what reality really is. And we all buy into it, but we don't have to. There are other ways. And although it might mean making a lot of sacrifices, and you might be end up, you know, never having much money to do some of the things other people do, which is definitely the state I've always been in. The rewards you get from choosing your own path, yeah, which in my case was going for a 6-month walk and discovering a level of meaning and purpose in life and connection to nature that I'd never imagined. And so that 6-month walk made me realize that, you know, that was what I was meant to do. And I decided I wanted to do a walk which didn't end when the summer ended, but continued for a year and a half, which became a way of life, which is why I began my longest walk from the bottom of Italy to the top of Norway. And that journey wasn't about, it wasn't about getting from A to B. It wasn't about, you know, getting somewhere. It was all just about being somewhere. It was an excuse to spend time outdoors in nature, just living the life I knew I was meant to live. And I didn't know why I was called to it again back then. I didn't go to discover myself or my place in the universe. I just went because it was the only option for me. Although it taught me so much, it was only when really writing about it that I was finally able to intellectually articulate why it had the incredible transformative impact it did. I imagine, as you know, from writing about Kinder Scout now with your book, that simply through doing that, you see the hill in ways you potentially didn't even imagine before you started writing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's changed everything. Even though I was already spending so much time up there, it transformed absolutely everything. And it's made me make some really big decisions in my personal life as well. Yeah, when you're writing about it and connecting with it in a really slow way, you see everything differently. I think you see everything differently while you're up there. But you see everything differently at home as well, and you see all the people around you differently. And it was the interactions that I had with people when I was up there as well, you know, because I was lingering, I was looking, I was, yeah, just spending so much time up there that I ended up having these absolutely incredible conversations and interactions with people. It almost seems like a dream now. It feels like it was a different lifetime, but condensed into 3 months.
I sense you're going to write a lot more about Kinder in years ahead of us still. And yeah, that relationship with a place will go even deeper. That's fantastic. Yeah, goes back to what I said, that writing, even if no one ever reads it, the very act of trying to figure stuff out by writing is such an incredible way of growing, moving forward as a person.
Yeah, and it really humbled me, and it really made me realize that I know nothing. You know, I know so little about this place that I run and I walk and I talk about and I connect with others. And I still feel people say to me, "Oh, you must know Kinder like the back of your hand." And I just say to them, "God, no, I'm not even close." It's different as well, isn't it? Like if you sleep on Kinder, if you're up there under a full moon, I mean, I'd love you to share a little bit about your night that you very kindly shared with me on a Facebook post, and you described this experience that you had. I'd love if you could share that
Yes,
experience.
sure. I mean, yeah, but that's the thing about knowledge, first off, is yeah, the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. And it's the people who feel they know anything, know everything, are the ones to yeah, be most wary of. To get to know any hill, but especially a place like Kinder, you can't just visit in summer during the day. You have to be there at all times of year and in all weathers and at all times of day too. And the people who don't know a mountain by night, only, you know, if you only know a mountain by daytime, you only half know a mountain, because half of the year it's dark up there. I think I was 19. It was my second winter of walking, and I saw that the full moon was around. It was late in the year, no, November, and the forecast was for clear skies overnight. So I came up with this ridiculously scary idea of going for a night hike on Kinder, which was something I'd never done at that point. But there was a full moon and clear sky, so I figured it would be okay. And it was spectacular on the hike up. I didn't need to turn on my torch, which back then was just a bicycle lamp, was all I had to carry. It wasn't a head torch or anything. It was just ridiculous. But I didn't even need to turn it on because visibility was so good. But by the time I got up onto the plateau, the clag had formed from nowhere. So it was truly dark. The moon just wasn't penetrating this thick cloud. It was just this murky darkness. I swear I couldn't even see my feet. And I probably could, but it felt like I couldn't see my feet. And so trying to stick even on the big path that skirts the southern edges, which back then wasn't stone flagged, it was just that, in the late 80s, it was this massively wide, churned up quagmire, which at that time of year was even more quagmire-ish than usual. I kept wandering from it, and it was just crazy. And so I spent hours and hours in this murk, not making much progress, feeling intimidated and awed, but kind of enjoying the discomfort level of it. And then all of a sudden, it was like 2 a.m. All of a sudden, there was like a shift in the air, something that couldn't really be measured, just felt. And the clag suddenly dropped into the Vale of Edel, just like that, within seconds. What had been murky and impossible to negotiate was suddenly below me, this wonderful, shifting silver surface of cloud. It was like a giant witch's cauldron that was just like stirring gently. And I was above it in pristine clarity under a bright moon. It was like my chin was probably brushing the heather at my feet. It was just so incredible. And it only lasted 5 minutes. But while it was happening, it was like a lifetime. The way time slows in nature. Just an incredible moment. 5 minutes, then there was that shift again, and the clag just rose back up. It was like a gift from the gods of nature or the weather gods that made losing a night's sleep and toiling up a mountain in the dark and wandering, stumbling through the clag for 3 hours so worthwhile. It even mentioned like one of the scariest moments I've had on Kinder that followed a couple of hours later after being in the fog, because I continued on that journey, elevated from what I just experienced. But as time went by, I felt even more constrained by this murkiness. And somewhere between the Druid's Stone and the intriguingly named Mad Woman's Stones, which I know everyone talks about, somewhere midway between those two enigmatically named points, I started hearing footsteps behind me, which was interesting after being alone in the fog for so long. So I stopped and looked around behind me, couldn't see anything in the fog. The footsteps stopped as I stopped. I thought, well, maybe I'm just flicking mad off my heels or something. That's all it is. So I started walking. The footsteps started again. I stopped. Footsteps stopped. I started, that sudden rush of adrenaline you get. Well, what the heck's happening here? I thought, I know, I'll turn around and walk towards the footsteps, which was kind of a bold move. And I did that, and there was nothing behind me where the footsteps had been coming from. But now they were coming from behind me again, which was incredibly terrifying. So I thought, hang on. I'll turn on my headlamp, and maybe I actually know the headlamp. Maybe it's following me because it can see my headlamp. So I turned off my headlamp, which plunged me into, real crazy darkness. And that was like, ah, no, headlamp light back on, horrible. So I thought, okay, I can deal with this. I can deal with this. I'm going to keep walking. It's nothing bad. And I kept walking, and the footsteps resumed. Now I'm so freaked out by this point. I finally stopped, and this time the footsteps. It was like 3 steps after I'd stopped. And that did it. My nerve broke. I just took off like a raving loony and stumbled down Crookstone Moor and down Jagger's Clough and got the hell out of there. And it was truly terrifying end to a very incident-filled night hike. And I don't know, if it was just me flicking mud off my shoes or whether it was just sheep, whatever it was.
I've got goosebumps.
A fun memory to have from the Mad Woman Stones area, anyway. And I'm sure it wasn't supernatural. It was just a sheep. It was just my imagination. Whatever. I'm not a very superstitious person. Although some places do have an atmosphere and aura. It's very interesting. Some places do somehow retain something of their history. On my longest walk, when I passed through the Dolomites and stepped down into an old World War I trench, the atmosphere of horror of what these, young people who were younger than me had gone through, being in a war they didn't necessarily have any real connection to, dying up there in a trench in the Alps. It was to me, it was such a palpable thing. So places do retain somehow something of what they really are. That's a whole nother direction we could go.
I can tell you're a writer just because of the way that you speak and because you're such a great storyteller. And I think it really is a talent to be able to put those experiences into words like you did. But that's your profession. That's what you do.
If only I could make an actual living out of writing. As you know, it's very hard as a writer to make ends meet, but we'll get there one day. We'll get there
Yeah,
one day.
do you work in another field?
My day job is as a graphic designer and illustrator. I mix it up. I do some graphic design work locally, and it's fun to work for smaller non-profits, which for charities in your own town, because you can see you're having a real impact in the world. I sell some photos, not very many, and I do a little bit of writing. I'm also a dad of two larger teenagers now, so I'm, chef, chauffeur, all kind. We all have so many hats on. We're so much more than our like main job that doesn't really define who we are. I'm at a stage of life where potential retirement is maybe 10 years away if I'm lucky. But for me, retirement, what it really means is I can push aside the other jobs and I can purely focus on hiking and writing about it. And
Yes.
it becomes not really a job, but just a way of life. So there's so many big walks I still want to do. And yes, so many adventures I want to have and things I feel I still want to try and share, and to have the time a little bit later in life to really do it. Like, I know I have to go back to Kinder Scout. And if you're still living in Edel, then I'll have to call by and say hello for
Oh,
sure.
yes. Yeah, I'd love to join you for a bit of your walk as well, although it sounds like you might need some alone time up there. You've got to.
I became a very functioning introvert. Like I say, earlier on, I learned my place in society. I learned that I am a member of a social species. Species for a reason. So I end up now typically being the kind of person who, when I meet strangers, is they're the ones that start backing off nervously because I'm too friendly and too interested in them. So I've definitely changed,
That's
maybe not for
incredible.
the
No, I think it is. And I love the joy that comes through your writing, like that one that you posted on your blog the other day about that encounter that you had and that shared joy and them asking you about your age.
Part of it's founded on the knowledge I have of how we are connected to the natural world that shaped us. I can see that people I meet who may have had a completely different life to me, and different experiences and different values, different beliefs, whether religious or otherwise or political, deep down, we all have that same innate connection. We are all the same. And so when you encounter someone who's also overcome by joy of a particular moment in nature, and you are the same as them and you're enjoying it for the same reasons, it's such a meaningful thing. It's why people are so much friendlier when you're out in the hills, willing to stop and chat the way they wouldn't necessarily if you're on a city street hurrying to get to work or somewhere else. It's known that nature, through studies, makes people less aggressive and more social. It's a fact of how we react to natural places. And maybe I've changed to that level because of that aspect of what nature does to us, because I've spent so long out there. It's made me overly friendly as a result.
I think that joy does come through, doesn't it? And it sounds like you've redefined your life a couple of times. What would you say? Because I think there's some people who listen to this podcast who are scared of coming to, well, not just going up Kinder Scout, but going to the mountains or spending time alone in the hills. What would you say to them if you think back to your first time coming here?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because the fear comes from, I mean, there's so many reasons. Like, people are scared of other people as one of the reasons. And I don't know if anything I can say can overcome that, other than I believe that most people are good and kind and generous from firsthand experience, from being in a place where I had to rely on strangers for help. I've discovered that the world is a much friendlier place than the media would have us believe. I understand the fear of the wild because I was brought up to have that fear. And I eventually learnt that for the most part, it was misplaced. I mean, there are, you do have to be aware of your own abilities and of the conditions. Like, fear, not being scared of the wild doesn't mean you can go up to the middle of Kinder Scout in January just wearing shorts with your shirt off and think you're going to have a good time. It's, there's a level of real, you have to be realistic about these things. I would say to someone who's too scared to go up onto Kinder, when you go on your first visit, go 50 yards up Kinder Scout and then stop and say, am I okay here? Is this all right? What can go wrong? Can I get out? Can I get back easily? And just take baby steps, maybe. Maybe you find your way in the wild slowly, and you don't have these high expectations of the fact that you have to be standing on top of no stool taking that perfect Instagram shot. You can just go half a mile up Grimsbrook and find out if you're comfortable with that, and do it slowly. And of course you can, I mean, there are groups you can join, organized, informal, whatever. But for me, I think you have to be in nature on your own to really find that connection of self-growth, because with people, there are distractions, inevitable, and as beneficial as some of them are. And I think to go on your own, if you're not comfortable, it just has to be a process, and it might take years. And you just have to be patient with yourself and accept where you are. Baby steps, can take you on a 7,000-mile journey. Once each step is what counts in the moment. It doesn't have to be a destination right at the start.
Yeah, and I started going out on my own when I lived down south in London. I used to just take the train somewhere and start exploring. And so I got used to spending that time with myself and holding a map and really looking at it and trying to figure it out. And then eventually I did come up here from London, and it was the best decision I've ever made.
Exactly. My best decision I ever made was quitting work and changing my job. And it seemed like such a hard decision. And then afterwards, looking back, it was, why did that take me so long? It was clearly the right decision. I think it's trusting your instinct, being open to, if there's a little voice inside of you that's saying, I want to do this, listen to that voice and act upon it to your comfort level, and just push a tiny bit beyond that comfort level. You don't have to go into red, but you don't have to stay in green. You can go to that orange in between just a little bit and grow through doing that.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's this idea that you either stay where you are and you stay comfortable, or you take the leap into something massive. And actually, there's so much that can happen in between throughout your whole life. Your whole life, I think, is that journey of just like these little baby steps. And sometimes that is actually physical, like like with your long distance walks.
We like to live in comfort. It's like a human desire. And there's a term like the golden handcuffs. You've created this comfortable life, and you have everything you think you need. And yet it's keeping you from what deep down you really want. You're like locked into place because you have a job that is, you're going to be able to retire on, and you can afford to get, go to the movies and eat out or whatever. And but as wonderful as it all is, it's still keeping you, these golden handcuffs, from being who you might deep down still want to really be. And it is hard to break through, but it can be done. And I guess, as we've done, the assurance is once you've made that choice, you realize actually that was a good choice.
When you're looking back on it, but it's like some you can get caught up in trying to match your own level of existence. It's like you've got to a certain level, and a lot of people worry about backtracking, whether it's living standards, finances, whatever it is, what other people will think. Before you know it, years and years and years can go by, and all you're trying to do is just keep up with yourself. And I think you tend to know those things early on in life, don't you? You tend to actually, I knew that I loved the outdoors from a very young age, but I neglected it for a good 10 years, and that did a lot of damage, and it took me a long time to get it back. And yeah, some people leave it much longer than that.
The beautiful thing is, no matter what you've done or the choices you've made, every single morning when you wake up, you still have that opportunity to make that day a day the best version of yourself you can be, and you can make the best choices you can make, no matter the regrets you have about the past. I so strongly believe that every single morning you still have an opportunity to start fresh. It can be a courageous and frightening thing to do to make those big changes. But I say it doesn't have to be a big change. It can be a baby step. You can say, you know what, this weekend, my dear spouse, I have to carve out 24 hours for myself. I'm going to take the train from London to Wendover and go walk through the Chilterns. Or if you're in Sheffield, I'm going to go for a jaunt on Kinder Scout, and I really need this. And sometimes you have to advocate for yourself in that way.
If you imagine yourself now, if you can cast yourself back or even just cast yourself to your imagination of standing up on Kinder or sitting in your bivvy, what makes you wild about Kinder Scout?
I really think it's freedom is the word. I really think it is freedom to untether yourself from the normal working week and from the normal expectations and demands that society places on us. It's just the freedom to be yourself in nature that Kinder grants, like few other places. It really is different in nature and characteristics. I guess, and yeah, that's what makes me wild about it. It's just, it is the dictionary definition of freedom. It should be there in a dictionary. You should look up freedom, and right after it should be Kinder Scout, and that's all the definition you need.
And I think it's so interesting, as someone who has traveled and you've literally traveled on foot to all sorts of places, it is absolutely fascinating to hear you talk about Kinder Scout in that way.
Yeah, there's nowhere on the planet more special or more beautiful than Kinder. There are places equally beautiful in thousands of different ways, but Kinder Scout, which some people just see as, land at the end of its tether, this morass of clinging chocolate peat, can be devalued because you can see industrial cities on the horizon, and the weather's frequently not what you might want it to be. But it really is as special and magical and valuable as anywhere. And more so than many places.
Wow, I can't believe I've met you. Incredible.
I feel the same way. I feel the same way. Thank you so much. It's such an honor.
It's been so lovely to chat to you, and I hope that we can chat again. I'm so drawn to your energy and your blog post that you wrote and the way you express yourself and the things you've shared today that are just so inspiring.
I'm excited to read your descriptions of the various walks and be taken back myself. And I know your photos are so beautiful. You really capture the spirit of Kinder. It's so good to see.
Oh,
So
thank you.
I can't wait to have that in my library next to my treasured my first 1 to 25,000 map that I have and love, and a little book I bought from Cicerone Press back in 1989 called The Kinder Log.
Oh no, I haven't got that.
Have you heard of
Oh,
this?
someone posted a picture of that on Twitter the other day.
And it's so, it's so basic. It's not overly designed,
Yeah,
but
I'll have to get myself a copy.
it's such a treasure trove of information about a hill that I do genuinely love. So, I'll be able to add your book to that collection.
Yes.
It will
Yeah.
sit there
Oh,
with.
wow. Amazing. It's going to be in Colorado. That's so exciting. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing your stories. And yeah, as I said, I'd love to chat to you
Yeah,
again. And
we'll
I'm going to go
talk.
and buy your books.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much. And yeah, we'll stay in touch.
Yes. Yeah. Have a lovely day.
You too. Have a good evening, Sarah.
Bye
Bye.
bye.